from deep inside your radio.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, back in the Le Show Dome, and it doesn't take long to, when you've been away from Los Angeles for a while, it doesn't take long to realize that, not speaking about Santa Monica now, this is still just the home of the homeless, but it doesn't take long to realize that Los Angeles is a city of snakes and snake handlers, which is, you know, can be a good thing. It's not a knock. Now, how's this war on terror going? A couple of straws in the wind this week that you might not have noticed. There's a defense spending bill wending its way, as they do, through Congress. This one's through the Senate. And the Obama administration has objected to one of the provisions in the bill. Any guesses? You know, what could be in the defense spending bill that the Obama administration might object to? A ban on the military's use of private contractors to interrogate detainees. Because we need those. Now, just to review, the private contractors who supervised the detainee interrogations back in the good old days, you know, 83 waterboardings in a month, had never actually interrogated any detainees before they put the program into practice. Because, you know, you can read up on that. The ban on private contractors is strongly backed by the Senate chairman, the Democratic chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Carl Levin. He describes interrogations of prisoners as, quote, an inherently governmental function, which just means he hasn't read enough Grover Norquist, that cannot be transferred to contractor personnel. A White House statement says it has serious concerns. Says the Pentagon spokesman, Obama and Defense Secretary Robert Gates are, quote, as serious as a heart attack about this, end quote. You know, those heart attacks can be kind of comical when you really look at them the right way. The provision in the bill says the interrogation of enemy prisoners of war, civilian internees, retained persons, other detainees, terrorists, and criminals when captured, transferred, confined, or detained, blah, blah, is an inherently governmental function and cannot be transferred to contractor personnel. The White House says in some limited cases, contractor skills might be necessary to obtain critical information. You can't make an artificial, because some of the contractors that can still be used, according to the Senate bill, would be interpreters. And the White House says you can't make an artificial distinction between an interrogator and an interpreter who's actually going to be the one asking the questions. Yeah, that is so very artificial. Guess what I say? You don't want to inhibit the ability to extract valuable intelligence that could save lives, here we go, by not being able to use subject matter experts, linguists, or other contract personnel, especially since we're firing them from the armed forces for being gay. Says one spokesperson. No, I'm not going to quote him because he's not identified. So, you know, he can go identify himself if he wants to get quoted on this program. And another straw in the wind. While people in this country concentrate on Guantanamo, if they are looking at American prisoners, detainees, and the way they're treated, there's this other prison not being mentioned. President Obama has not pledged to close it down within a year. It's Bagram in Afghanistan, and the prisoners there have refused to leave their cells for at least the past 2 weeks to protest against their indefinite imprisonment. This is a rare glimpse inside a facility that's even more closed off than Gitmo. News about the protest only came to light when the International Committee of the Red Cross informed the families of several of the detainees that scheduled video teleconferences and family visits were being canceled because of the protest. Unlike at Guantanamo Bay, where detainees have access to lawyers, the 620 prisoners at Bagram, and by the way, we're expanding that, we're expecting more guests coming, are not permitted to visit with their attorneys. Afghan government representatives are generally not allowed to visit or inspect Bagram either. The detainees are protesting being held indefinitely without trial or legal recourse. In recent years, as Guantanamo Bay came under more scrutiny, Bagram has become the destination for many suspects. The population has ballooned there. U.S. officials are building a facility that will hold nearly 1,000. In April of this year, a district judge ruled that the Supreme Court decision that extended habeas corpus rights to Gitmo detainees also applies to a certain set of those held at Bagram, those who are not arrested in Afghanistan and who are not Afghan citizens. The Obama Justice Department, you'll be glad to know, has appealed that decision. Tough on terror. You bet. Hello, welcome to the show. From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, Tales of Airport Security. This from Missy. We just got back from our summer vacation and had this interesting experience. My husband's name is very common. Jim Thompson. On our trip to Florida, Jim flew out several days after our son and me and had no difficulties. On the way home, we all flew together. When checking our bags at Tampa International for our return flight to Portland, the self-service kiosk printed out boarding passes for both legs of the trip for our son and myself, but only the first leg, Tampa to L.A., for Jim. We didn't notice this until our bags were checked through and we were at the gate for boarding, and so figured we'd get Jim's Portland boarding pass on arrival at LAX. But when Jim tried to print a boarding pass from the kiosk at LAX, an error message flashed on the screen, and so we had to join the line of bag-checking passengers in LA's bus terminal homage of a ticketing level. Hey! When we finally reached the counter and explained ourselves, the Alaska Airlines rep clattered the keyboard for a full minute with eyes conspicuously averted, after which she turned and left, taking Jim's driver's license with her. 10 minutes later, she returned, and without explanation, printed out a boarding pass, handing it to Jim, along with his confiscated license. When we asked what the problem had been, the rep said that Jim's name was, quote, too common, unquote, and they had to make sure that either, one, it wasn't an alias, or two, that he wasn't one of the Jim Thompsons on the terrorist watch list. Amazingly, somehow Jim was an upstanding citizen when we checked in at Tampa at 6 a.m. that morning, but had become a suspect individual by afternoon, as TSA remarkably knew he would when they refused to grant the boarding pass for the second half of his journey, but let him take the first flight anyway. Concludes Missy, I feel so much safer now. Tales of Airport Security, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. But there's more copyrighted features.
I deaf, no deaf, take my hand. It's a digital wonderland. Got to be so careful where you stand. In the digital wonderland.
Okay, it's, I guess we're a month in now to the switchover, and the Nielsen people who put out those amazingly accurate ratings now say that 200,000 homes have enabled themselves to watch digital television in the last 2 weeks. More than 1 million households have come up to digital in the month since the mandated transition. And so, according to Nielsen, 1.5 million American households are unable to receive digital television signals as of now. There are just 2 more weeks left in the federal government's converter subsidy program. Nearly 63 million coupons have been mailed to households among the 34 million approved for up to two each. More than 33 million had been redeemed. 25 million had exceeded their 90-day expiration date. Applications being taken through the end of the month. As long as the program has funds, How are you supposed to know that? 1.3 million people can't see television now. Congratulations to them. Send a cake. But just in case that sounds like a piddling number to you, if Jon Stewart gets that many viewers in an evening, he's happy. From Stephen, I'm single, divorced, do home remodeling, self-employed. I resent paying for TV when I still have to watch commercials. Try going to the movies or a ball game, I say. Stephen continues, most people forget cable was sold as sold to us as commercial-free. Yeah, most people forget TV used to be good. I live in an inner-ring suburb of Cleveland, Stephen writes, just a few miles from downtown. I live near the lake. Unfortunately, I have a 300-foot hill between me and the broadcasting towers. My TV watching is based entirely on what comes in on any given day. When I do get a picture, it is constantly broken into pixels. I scan whenever I turn on the TV. I never know what channels will come in. I bought a $120 digital aerial and a $20 signal amplifier, and this is as good as it gets. Thanks for the great show, says Stephen. Ethan, Harry, being a cable subscriber, I never thought I'd be emailing you about this issue, but alas, it affects even me. At least once a week, I'm awakened to the sounds of an aluminum ladder being precariously set up on my back porch, followed by footsteps on the roof. The reason? My landlady, an elderly woman, spent a ton of money to update her TV and install a digital antenna on the roof so she could continue to watch TV. Of course, she has reception issues, and once a week when the gardeners are on the property, has to have them go up on the roof to move her antenna so she can try and recapture the signal, which she had perfectly only 1 week before. Last week, one of the gardeners went up, slipped, and almost fell off the roof. I suspect it won't be long before someone sues the government for injury sustained while adjusting their digital antenna. Sincerely, Ethan. Dear Harry, Dave Smith in Pennsylvania. Devon. Dave went to Devon. After the switch over to digital occurred last month, I realized that if I wanted to continue watching TV, I would have to get a converter box. Since I'd requested a coupon from the FCC months earlier, I dug out my coupon only to realize it had expired. So I went online again and requested a new coupon, which finally arrived last week. I walked into my local Radio Shack with my old TV and the coupon, and the clerk burst out laughing. He tells me it's not worth it to buy the converter box. Even with the coupon, it will cost me $20. Because I will also have to buy a new antenna, and even then it probably won't work unless I use it on the third floor of my house or live on a hill. He went on to say that he has had dozens of customers from our suburban area who bought converter boxes and new antennas and still cannot receive Philadelphia Channel 6 or 12, that would just be ABC and PBS, even though we're only 20 miles or so from Philadelphia. Up until the digital conversion, I had great TV reception just using rabbit ears. So I'm now without TV reception and thinking I'm probably better off without it. Am I missing anything? I'll give you mine. And Robert writes, Harry, before the switchover, I needed a new decktop antenna and bought a digital antenna. It looked small in the catalog, but I thought, well, maybe it won't get the lower VHF channels, but the price was right, $20. It was even smaller than I anticipated. I thought it might be good for channel 50 and above. As a test, I hooked it up to my computer monitor, which also has a coax antenna input for both analog and digital. Imagine my surprise after a scan to find it picked up channel 2 analog as well as channel 2 digital and all higher local analog and digital channels in numerical order. The secret was it had a 10 dB built-in amplifier, which compensated well enough for the small antenna. I live about 50 miles away from Mount Wilson, where all the LA TV transmitters are located. Inside the handbook, it noted the antenna had been certified to receive all the digital TV channels in Britain. So it was a bit of a scam to sell it in the USA, and I took a bit of a gamble, but it paid off. Lesson for those having trouble getting a weak signal before moving the antenna around? Get off that ladder! Or buying a new expensive one? A coax cable amplifier sells for $10 to $30 depending on the gain, and one of those may solve your problem inexpensively and at low cost. Works even for rabbit ears, as low as $2. Okay, thank you, Robert. Just to watch TV, you got to do all that. And wait till we get digital radio. Well, we have it, but wait till you get it. Let's see how easy that is. News of the digital wonderland, ladies and gentlemen. It is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And when I say that, of course, I'm lying. So don't worry about it. It's just exploratory. You know what I'm saying? That is to say, even if it's real, it's just exploratory. But now we haven't had a visit from this department in a week or so. So it's time, ladies and gentlemen, for News of the Warm. The award-winning News of the Warm. I don't point that out often enough. But it's true.
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
There's so much News of the Warm this week. That's why it's sort of up here at the front of the program. A massive pulse of carbon dioxide entered the world's atmosphere 55 million years ago in association with a significant rise in global temperature. But it seems to have gotten a lot hotter than it should have. University of Hawaii researchers who studied the ancient climate event say there are major puzzles about how the atmosphere responded to the input of carbon, puzzles that may be important in the Earth's current human-caused pulse of CO2. One issue is understanding feedback mechanisms. You can calculate how much warmer the atmosphere ought to get by adding carbon dioxide to it, but back in the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum, those were the days, 55 million years ago, the temperature got significantly warmer than the amount of new carbon dioxide justified. Something else must have come into play. During that period, the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum, the temperatures rose 5 to 9 degrees Celsius. There wasn't enough carbon dioxide to justify that much temperature rise, says Richard Zeeby. Richard Zeeby, not Richard Beebe, Richard Zeeby, the University of Hawaii oceanographer who led a team that looked into the question, published in the journal Nature Geosciences. They collected deep sea sediment cores that date back to that period. The implication for modern humans is whether if we keep dumping carbon dioxide into the air, some feedback mechanism will kick in, causing rapid climate warming. The initial source of the Paleocene-Eocene carbon isn't entirely clear. It came from some natural carbon reservoir. The source remains an open issue, according to the paper. One possibility is that the warming caused the release of other greenhouse gases, which in turn prompted more warming. Clearly, things were different on the planet 55 million years ago, but the possibility of a big unexpected hike in temperatures is something we need to know about. This gap needs to be filled to confidently predict future climate change, write the authors of the article. The findings of a major new study are consistent with gradual changes of current systems in the North Atlantic rather than a more sudden shutdown that could lead to rapid climate change in Europe and elsewhere, i.e. no tipping point. The research, based on the longest experiment of its type ever run on a general circulation model simulating the Earth's climate for 21,000 years back to the height of the Ice Age, shows that major changes to these important ocean current systems occur, but they may take place more slowly and gradually than had been suggested. These findings, published in Science, are consistent with other recent studies that are moving away from the theory of an abrupt tipping point that might cause dramatic atmospheric temperature and ocean changes in as little as 50 years. The phenomenon may happen, but probably not as a sudden threshold we're crossing, says Peter Clark, professor of geosciences at Oregon State. Is he a beaver or a duck? Doesn't say. Hundreds of images derived from classified data that could be used to better understand rapid loss and transformation of Arctic sea ice should be immediately released and disseminated to the scientific research community, says the National Research Council. Well, why isn't it? Because it's classified. These Arctic images show detailed melting and freezing processes and also provide information that's important for studying effects of climate change on sea ice and habitat data not available elsewhere. But right now, it's classified. The National Research Council has something else to say on another subject. We'll get to that in a moment. But finally, in news from the warm, widely sought efforts to reduce fuels that increase catastrophic fires in Pacific Northwest forests, you know, fighting forest fires, will be counterproductive to the goal of sequestering carbon to help offset global warming, according to forestry researchers at Oregon State. Even if the biofuels were used in an optimal manner to produce electricity, there will still be a net loss of carbon sequestration in the forests for at least 100 years and probably much longer. Fuel reduction treatment should be foregone if forest ecosystems are to provide maximum amelioration of atmospheric CO2. So let it burn. Now, there is one more. From the Times of London, the Great Barrier Reef will be so degraded by warming waters that it will be unrecognizable within 20 years. Well, I expect to be unrecognizable within 20 years. Oh, I see what you mean. This according to an eminent marine scientist, Charlie Vernon, former chief scientist of the Australian Institute of Marine Science, says there is no way out, no loopholes. The Great Barrier Reef will be over within 20 years or so. News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, it's a copyright feature of this broadcast. So we had the edifying spectacle this week of the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings into the nomination of Judge Sonia Sotomayor to be Supreme Court Justice. You learn so much about her and about the law watching those hearings, didn't you? Oh, and this. Interesting. We're getting a 3 or 4 minute warning here that there may be a new development in the Sonia Sotomayor case that we, I think, are going to cover live because it's the weekend and, you know, I don't have much, I didn't bring much with me, so we might as well go to live coverage. So we will go to Continental Public Radio for that moments from now here on Le Show.
CPR, Continental Public Radio. This is continuing and resuming coverage of the hearings of the Senate Judiciary Committee into the Supreme Court nomination of Judge Sonia Sotomayor. I'm Ira Zitkin, and a late request by the Republican minority members of the committee has resulted in this unusual weekend session, wrapping up Judge Sotomayor's week of testimony before the committee. Several members have requested additional time to, in their words, extend and complete their questioning of the nominee, who is resplendent today in a rust-colored blazer and black blouse. Not that I wouldn't describe the clothing of a male nominee, too. It's just that... And now I'm being given the signal that the Chairman Pat Leahy of Vermont is being given the signal to gavel this session into session. He looks nice, too.
as I mentioned earlier this week, when we were supposed to be here, we had a great deal of comedy and cooperation on this committee during past nomination processes, and the chairman has, in my opinion, tried very hard to preserve that tradition during these hearings. The Republican members, however, late Friday afternoon, requested this additional session, and so I felt, to preserve the spirit of comedy and cooperation that this move seemed designed to destroy, I felt I had no choice but to agree. So here some of us are again, Judge.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And so to preserve what's left of our tradition on this committee of cooperation, I'm going to call first on Senator Graham.
Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina.
I'm talking.
Carolina.
Judge Sotomayor, I've said this before, but I'm going to try to be brief.
Senator, I'll do the same.
Okay. I just want to get through these in the accelerated timetable that the chairman has for some reason chosen to impose on us today.
Because some of us don't want to get in some golf today.
That was Senator Lane.
That was probably the most important thing I'm going to say today. Anyway, Judge, just one last, very last time, I promise you, about...
How wise Latina, Senator. I look forward to it.
Really?
I look forward to it being the last.
I think we all do, except for some of us up here. All right, Judge, I'm going to read down a list of kinds of people here. And in each case, I would ask you, for reasons of time, just to give a yes or no answer as to whether each particular kind of person would be more or less likely than a white male to give a good decision as a judge. All right? You with me?
I'm following you, Senator.
All right. It's close enough. All right. Here's the list. And just, again, Judge, just answer after each one. A Latina of average intelligence.
I think so.
A wise Hawaiian lady.
Oh, I would think so, very much so.
An African-American man with Asperger syndrome.
Probably.
A very attractive Argentine woman.
Senator, I'm going to assume so.
All right, that shouldn't have been on my list anyway, Judge. I think one of my staffers inserted that. It kind of... a weekend prank. My apologies. Let me just continue here. An Alaskan former beauty queen?
These days, Senator, those pageants are very, very focused on education. I would think so.
A Chinese-American type A woman with a moderate to severe alcohol problem?
Senator, that's getting into a level of granularity that I just don't feel comfortable responding to without... Yeah. Taking some time to do some research, for example, on how people function with that kind of a problem.
Or don't.
Or don't, and of course, Senator.
A blind Presbyterian?
Well, Senator, I'm assuming this is someone who's mastered a reading system into which the major law journals are published, then absolutely, yes.
A Mexican-American high school dropout who's now working as a night cashier at a Wendy's?
Senator, I've known some very impressive autodidacts, as I think they're called in my time. It's entirely possible.
Excuse me, how much more time does the senator need?
Just a few more here. How about a bat-faced Jehovah's Witness from Cleveland?
Senator, first of all, I'd want to know a little bit more about whether this
means a person really possessing the face of a bat. Or
some of our stations will leave us now for Pledge Drive or other fine local programming. Our coverage continues here on CPR, Continental Public Radio.
In many communities, bat face may well serve as an ironic form of endearment.
Back here at Le Show Dome. And more good news about FEMA. Not only can they not protect you or help you with your housing needs once you've been flooded out by a natural disaster or by the malfeasance of the federal government, but they can flood you themselves. Dateline Texarkana, Texas, an Arkansas chicken farmer claims a neighboring FEMA trailer storage lot is causing his land to flood and is hurting his poultry business. According to plaintiff Ronald Buck, FEMA leased property from an airport in Hope, Arkansas. You remember Hope, Arkansas. You remember that facility, so it could store thousands of mobile homes and travel trailers that it couldn't use during Katrina because I don't know why they couldn't use them. They just said they couldn't, and they parked them in Hope, Arkansas. So in preparing the site, FEMA had the land graded. Buck, the neighbor, claims the grading of the trailer lot now causes his adjacent property to flood with even the smallest amount of rain. Buck says he's requested FEMA take action to prevent the excessive water flow, but the government agency has not taken any action. After filing his claim in writing and waiting 6 months for a remedy, Buck filed suit against FEMA on July 13th. But wait, there's more from the fine people. I mentioned earlier that there was another report from the National Research Council that might be of interest. And so there is. The Army Corps of Engineers roadmap for protecting coastal Louisiana from a Category 5 hurricane. That would seem important. Is substantially flawed because it fails to recommend a plan that can be adopted quickly, according to the National Research Council. The Corps' long overdue, it's 20 months overdue, ladies and gentlemen. They missed the deadline by just 20 months, because what's the urgency when you're dealing with hurricane protection? The Corps' long overdue Louisiana Coastal Protection and Restoration Program report, well, it took them 20 months to get through the title. This was congressionally mandated after the flooding of New Orleans in 2005. Instead of giving a clear plan, as mandated by Congress, lays out 27 alternatives, highlighting, as preferred, none. That's the way forward. The plan is not proposed and apparently does not intend to propose a single plan or preferred initial course of action, says the National Research Council, which evaluated the Army Corps draft. This means that actions for improving hurricane storm surge protection for southern Louisiana will be further delayed. Unquote. State officials have also complained about the approach, saying the lack of an actionable plan leaves Louisiana vulnerable. The NRC report does praise the Corps for identifying protection methods that do not involve building levees and flood walls, but criticizes the agency for failing to suggest how to coax the public to comply with the measures. Simply announcing that a non-structural measure such as elevating buildings can reduce flood damage will not necessarily result in buildings being elevated, the report says. The Corps plan does not deal with actions needed to actually persuade households to voluntarily take part in such a protection program, such as informing households of the risks they face, formulating standards for cost-effective elevation, and other non-structural mitigation measures. The National Research Council also critiqued the Corps' plan for rebuilding the rapidly deteriorating Louisiana coastline, noting that the agency fails to prove that enough sediment exists to maintain the current configuration. Rather than waste energy on trying to maintain the eroding shoreline, the Corps should focus on protecting and restoring high-priority areas, says the National Research Council. Also, disagreeing with the Corps' preference for working within existing congressional mandates for coastal restoration programs, it says the agency should push for new legislation specifically targeting Louisiana restoration, similar to the laws specifically developed for restoring the Florida Everglades. Finally, the National Research Council recommended that the Army Corps work with Louisiana officials to set priorities and take swift action. But they know that, don't they? They're the Army Corps of Engineers. They get things done. They know how to. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm being advised we have another bit of live coverage coming up. We'll get to it moments from now here on the show.
I once saw it in a book I had. God was by my side. My name and lights up there on the marquee, and God was very proud. I've been a miner for a heart of gold, a dreamer who just won't wake up. I thought I'd plunge into the deepest vein. It wasn't deep enough. And I will fall 100 stories and open up my hand and scatter all my dreams of glory like seeds upon the land. Picture on my wall of fame, next to the grocery list. I keep forgetting I should take you down. I'm gonna take you down. And I will fall 100 stories and open up my hand. Join the league of failures, and I will be resigned to fall 100 stories and leave it all behind. Promise to forgive the ones who took more than they gave. At least I'll have some peace of mind as I dig their graves. And on my way down, I hope to see the one I hurt the most. Perhaps he'll open up his window and we'll fly this ghost. And I will fall 100 stories and open up my hand and scatter all my dreams of glory like seeds upon the land. And I'll join the league of failures. I bet that I'll be glad to fall 100 stories and I'll have peace at last. And I'll set this house on fire and burn the whole thing down.
rejoin CPR's coverage of the Sotomayor hearings.
From CPR, Continental Public Radio, I'm Ira Zipkin, welcoming you back to our continuing coverage of this unprecedented weekend session of the Sonia Sotomayor nomination hearing. Senator Al Franken, the only Democrat besides the chairman to attend today's session, has just referred to Senator Grassley of Iowa as a distinguished big fat idiot, and the chairman is now gaveling the amused hearing room back to order. Here's Senator Franken.
I'm sorry, just trying to break some of the tension of this very long week. You know, Franny and I were looking forward to seeing Shoah this afternoon. It's out on Blu-ray.
No, it's a wonderful, affecting picture. Yeah. I saw it on VHS.
Getting back to our shared affection for the Perry Mason show.
Yes, Senator, I must admit, with all the cases I was reading each evening, I haven't been able to recall the name of that episode.
Yeah. For the record, that was the episode we talked about on Wednesday.
The only one in the whole series where the DA won the case.
Right. That's correct. Judge, since we're here at this extraordinary session, I was wondering whether, just for the record, I could read you a list of titles of the episodes, and maybe that would, as the lawyers on this committee like to say, refresh your recollection.
All right, Senator, I'll do my best.
I think you've been doing that all week.
Thank you.
Really? Okay. Just starting here. The case of the restless redhead.
No.
The case of the drowning duck.
I don't think so.
The case of the vagabond vixen.
You know, Senator, I don't even remember seeing that one.
I do. She was hot. The case of the runaway corpse.
It definitely wasn't that one.
The case of the fugitive nurse.
I tend to doubt it.
The case of the terrified typist.
You know, it's possible, mm-hmm. but I'm not really sure.
Okay, just a few more here.
Some of our stations will be leaving us now to perform unscheduled maintenance.
Well, I guess,
Our coverage continues.
That's it.
Supported by the Ethanol Foundation, trying hard not to influence news coverage of energy issues. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
The case of the jilted jockey.
Doesn't ring a bell.
And now, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
From Washington Senate Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus called the White House late this week and apologized for saying that the president's opposition to taxing health care benefits is, quote, not helping us get a health care reform bill. He apologized. Philadelphia's Valley Swim Club, I'm asked by the Pittsburgh desk to note that it's not in Pittsburgh, has apologized for turning away dozens of young swimmers from a local minority-based summer camp and denies that their intentions were race-based. The Valley Swim Club president said they were concerned that a lot of kids would change the complexion and the atmosphere of the club. A second statement was issued later. The Valley Club is deeply troubled by the recent allegations of racism, which are completely untrue. We had originally agreed to invite the camps to use our facility. Unfortunately, we quickly learned that we underestimated the capacity of our facilities, underestimated the capacity of our facilities, and realized that we could not accommodate the number of children from these camps. Interesting. All funds were returned to the camps. Our Valley Club deplores discrimination in any form. Children from one day camp reported hearing racist remarks, but members willing to talk to reporters denied those allegations. Okay. They underestimated the capacity, so they didn't have room for it. You see what I'm saying? According to three sources familiar with the closed-door meeting to discuss the ramifications of Washington, D.C. City Councilperson Marion Barry's July 4th arrest, the council member apologized to his colleagues. He even made sure to apologize to council member Jim Graham, who was late to the meeting. Barry confessed his love for the district and said he was sorry he had hurt the council. It really, really seemed heartfelt, the council member says. His colleagues were pretty damn ticked off at him. He apologized to all the members, said another source. The source added that Barry almost cried during his mea culpa, but Barry was clear whom he would not apologize to: the public. damn bitch set him up. Jetstar Airways, the budget unit of Qantas Airways, has apologized for late arrivals and poor customer service in New Zealand. But not to be left out. Still another airline is apologizing. The LIAT airline, which serves the Caribbean. This weekend it appealed to its customers for their continued patience and understanding. It addresses a series of challenges which have resulted in numerous delays and cancellations in recent days. On behalf of the rest of the management team, says Chief Executive Officer Brian Challenger, I would like to express heartfelt thanks to staff throughout the network who've come under tremendous pressure. And take the opportunity to apologize for the inconvenience caused to passengers. But at least they're in the Caribbean. Dayline Victoria, Spain. Catholic bishops from Spain's Basque region have apologized for keeping quiet about the killing of priests by right-wing forces during the Spanish Civil War. That would be this week's Catholic apology. The memory of these priests has never faded in the eyes of their families, parishioners, and nor in the eyes of the religious orders to which they belong. What is not justifiable or acceptable any longer is the silence in which our church's official media has wrapped their deaths, says Bishop Miguel Aramendia. We believe such a long silence was not only a wrongful omission, but also a lack of truth and an act against justice and charity, for which we humbly ask forgiveness from God and our brethren. A change of mood, a rolling billboard for a famous meat company made an unusual pit stop in a Wisconsin house. The Oscar Mayer Wiener Wagon crashed into a Mount Pleasant home. I believe that is Wisconsin? New York? Somewhere. Around noon on Friday, the police chief there says the 22-year-old woman driving the giant hot dog thought she was in reverse, but instead went forward, crashing into the deck and garage. The company has apologized to the homeowner and says it will work with insurance companies to finish fixing the damaged house. It's not just New Orleans. Former Pennsylvania State Senator Vincent Fumo was sentenced to 55 months this week for his federal corruption conviction. Fumo, a once powerful Democrat, received the sentence in an end of a five-month trial that ended with Fumo's conviction on all 137 counts against him. Toward the end of his statement, before sentencing, Fumo said, Judge, I apologize that I put you through this, not just the trial. I had to make tough decisions in my life, and I respect you. I can only ask for mercy and compassion. An international aid group has taken the unusual step of apologizing for a botched effort to distribute clothing in Africa. Enough, a group that seeks to assist the victims of genocide, was criticized for giving New York Knicks basketball jerseys to children living in refugee camps in eastern Chad and for the way it described the event on its blog. Alana Shaikh, a veteran aid worker and blog writer, called the clothing effort an idiotic, dehumanizing, tacky stunt because enough did not bring jerseys for everyone. That is to say, enough didn't bring enough. And because the organization said in its report that the kids devoured the gifts, a phrase she said makes the recipients sound like animals. In response, Enough apologized in its own blog article this week. The T-shirt distribution was not well thought out, and I should have better consulted with relief area experts before undertaking such as this, says Stella Kenny, who coordinated the clothing effort for Enough. She also says she may have made poor word choices in her description of the event. How about choosing New York Knicks jerseys? Aren't those kids depressed enough? Taiwan's defense ministry this week apologized after footage was broadcast of two male soldiers apparently involved in an obscene act of oral sex while on duty. The defense ministry is deeply sorry for the incident, which seriously damages military discipline, it says. 2 days after pulling the plug on a pair of controversial internet videos meant to enhance Fayetteville, North Carolina's image, the president of the Fayette Area Convention and Visitors Bureau apologized to anyone who may have been offended by the videos. Especially, he said, when men and women that are getting shot at are grateful for the humor and know that Fayetteville, North Carolina can provide that. Uh-oh. Humor by amateurs again, ladies and gentlemen. The viral video clips are meant to show that Fayetteville goes out of its way to support soldiers who call the city home. The videos were made by an advertising agency nearby. One of the videos shows soldiers riding the back of an old woman who is using a walker to cross the street. Other parts of the videos are racier. Humor by amateurs, ladies and gentlemen, always a good idea. News? No, the apologies of the week. That's what that was. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, 7.4 and 5 megahertz shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world through the internet, the two different locations, live and archived whenever you want at harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available for your smartphone through Stitcher.com. Available as a free download for members at www.audible.com. And available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And just be like hanging out more with the snake handlers than the snakes, if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. Email address for this broadcast and the playlists of music featured hereon, just a part of the ever-evolving panoply. Yes, it is a full panoply at harryshearer.com. A tip of the show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. And big, big extra thanks to Judith. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW, Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the homeless home. That is to say, the home of the homeless.